ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff with you today. Coming up, most staple food crops are expected to experience substantial production losses in the future due to climate change.
We estimate that in a high emissions future, agricultural productivity in aggregate drops by about 24%, right? So about a quarter of a productivity levels lost due to climate change.
That's coming up in the next 10 minutes or so. And we know that dams are very useful for livestock in good times, but they often do dry up in droughts. And there's been a bit of a push by the state government to get a sense of just how many dams are out there and how many of them are legal or not. And there's been a surprising number of illegal dams found as part of this probe. So I'm going to have a conversation about just how many dams have been found. And I'd be interested in your thoughts as well on the importance of dams in farmers' resilience and what can be done as an alternative, given that a lot of the dams that have been built are illegal, mainly in the Mount Lofty Ranges. That's coming up in the next half hour or so. We're also going to look at the details of the mental health support service package that the state government has announced. It's been funded through the drought package that was announced a couple of months ago. We're going to get some more details on that. But first up today, Australian dairy giant Bega Cheese hopes to muscle its way into buying Fonterra's Oceania division and potentially its global customer business, despite being apparently locked out of the sale by a legal dispute. Fonterra put its assets up for sale last year, including manufacturing sites across Victoria and Tasmania. Merchant Bank Kidder Williams chairperson David Williams has advised Bega for decades, and he thinks that an Australian business should have a chance to throw its hat into the ring.
We're asking the ACCC whether they have any objection to Bega buying the Australian assets. I mean, the ACCC doesn't have really any jurisdiction over what's happening in Sri Lanka or the New Zealand assets or so forth, but it'll go to the question of how much market power owning the Fonterra Australian assets Bega would have, and market power being not only just in supermarkets but more particularly in milk collection and pricing and so forth. We don't think, by the way, we have any ACCC issues, but this is boilerplating it and going through the usual approvals.
And this doesn't mean there is a sale agreement in place. It's something you can do before you've got an agreement.
Yes, you can do it long before you've got an agreement. You could do it on a soft basis even before you start. But no, there's definitely not a sale agreement in place, and that is part of the issue because Bega has made it very clear that it wants to be in the process and wants to bid for the Australian, New Zealand and perhaps the world assets.
Okay, so it hasn't ruled out the global business and the Sri Lanka arm as well?
No, it hasn't ruled that out at all. And that's a decision we'd make once we're in the data room. But so far we've been prevented from going into the data room.
What's keeping you out?
Fonterra. They're keeping us out. Why they're keeping us out, you need to ask them. But there's plenty of other people rumoured in the press to be have been interested and perhaps even to have made indicative offers for those assets.
What makes you think you can be competitive with the likes of, I mean, Lactalis has done the same thing, asked the ACCC and have made offers. There's a Japanese mob. Why? What makes Bega think it can be competitive with these companies?
Well, first of all, we are in Australia and we've got, of all the other bidders, we've got the most synergy. So we think just from a corporate governance perspective, the Fonterra board should allow us into the process if they're interested in maximising the price that they get the Australia and New Zealand assets. So we think, you know, but just demonstrably, we're so superior to anybody else in synergies alone, and therefore we should be allowed in the process. Don't forget also that they are distributing our Bega brand, and part of buying this would be to get that brand back and distribute it ourselves. There's a role for the Australian Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and Susan Ley on the opposition to really help make sure that there's an Australian in the bidding process.
If Bega does buy these assets, that makes it a massive dairy company. Is this sort of just playing on, I don't know, anti-foreign sentiment to make Bega more money?
No, on the contrary. It's just a normal commercial business transaction, which would, you know, lead to a lot of synergies for us, but it should lead to a higher price for Fonterra, and given that they're going to distribute that to some of their farmers, a higher price for New Zealand farmers as well. I mean, one of the other things we're doing, which nobody else can do, is that we're saying that we will give farmers the option of taking cash or taking shares in Bega. So, for example, there's a lot of farmers in New Zealand who are still prickly about the fact that Fonterra sold their iconic ice cream brand Tip Top, and are now prickly because they're selling the mainland brand, which is, again, one of their most iconic brands. So what we say to people is, listen, if you're a farmer and you want to still have and maintain a sort of an interest in this, then, take some shares in Bega, take some cash, take all cash, take all shares. We won't care, but we'll work out something for that, you know.
If you are a farmer, this is potentially taking out another player from the market and reducing competition. Don't they end up worse off?
Well, first things first, there's a number of countries involved here. But in Australia, it would take one of the parties out. You're quite right about that. But that's the reason why we and Lactalis are going through the ACCC. But we think that it's going to create better efficiency, which will lead to a higher sustainable milk price in Australia just because of milk collection and processing and so forth. But there's still plenty of competition in this country between us and the Chinese and the French in Lactalis and so forth.
Kitta Williams Chair David Williams there telling Meg Ferguson Began was still hopeful it would be able to enter the bidding process to buy Fonterra's assets. To the state government now, and the government has today unveiled details of the mental health support services it's funding through its drought support package. You might remember the $73 million package that was announced a couple of months ago includes $2.5 million for what the government calls a comprehensive mental health support strategy for Australian communities, South Australian communities impacted by the drought. So to talk us through some of the details, I'm joined by South Australian Mental Health Commissioner Tammy Allen. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So thank you for joining me today. There are a number of initiatives being rolled out. We might start off with the one that's attracting the most money, $1.2 million. It's going towards expanding the services of some trusted NGO mental health service providers across South Australia. That's Centrecare, Unity SA, Mind and Skylight. Can you talk to me what this money will be put towards?
Yes, certainly. So, I mean, firstly, it was about us going out to communities and saying, rather than just throwing money at the problem, what is it that actually works for you? What do you want? Who do you trust to deliver that? And they said to us, and there's a lot of us, obviously, that actually the people that are already working on the ground there are doing a good job. They just need more help. They need some more support. So there's some fantastic NGOs already working out in our rural communities. And those ones, you know, like Centrecare and Uniting SA and Skylight are doing wonderful things, but they didn't have enough staff on the ground. So this allows us to get skilled and trusted local services up and able to deliver those things like counselling, financial counsellors, rural business mentors, some more resources for local GPs so that you can support both individuals and groups. And that ranges everything from kind of what you need right now, which might be some financial assistance or some coping around stress, to what you might need a little bit more long term. So some support around your family to, you know, to put food on the table long term or to to work out what the consequences of environmental change are through, you know, counselling and putting some other things in place. So that's what mainly that money's going towards, yeah.
Do you have a sense of how many farmers have accessed those services? And I know some of them, like Centrecare, do have rural arms of their organisation, but a lot of them are geared towards more broader mental health support, like the NDIS and things like that.
No, we don't have a sense yet because these are being upscaled and rolled out as we speak. So who is using them right now, we don't know, other than the NGOs are saying they are at capacity. So being able to put some more people and some more resources on the ground so they can increase their capacity is important. What we do know so far is just the campaign showing people where to go and what things are out there and are being used and utilised have reached nearly 300,000 people just in the last 4 weeks. So it's something that our rural communities are really interested and engaged on knowing more about and knowing how to navigate those services.
Okay, so you have done a bit of a sort of community awareness program. How are you targeting farmers then to be able to know what sort of services are in their area and what they can access?
So the targeted social media campaign mostly has come from communities telling us what sorts of messages that would work for them, and they have been giving us that information, as well as Aboriginal communities and our cultural and linguistically diverse have said these are the messages that work for us to make sure that they get out to this group of people. So those have been really targeted campaigns for particular locations affected by drought, as well as particular groups of people that need specific things or specific things in language.
So this is more targeted at the general community rather than farmers?
Both. There is messages directly for farmers, directly for primary producers, and also for the large communities that live and work rurally but may not be in farming or primary producing themselves. So we've got, you know, amazing local cafe providers and corner store, people that have said, well, we are the people that our communities first come to because we're here making coffee every afternoon or handing out fodder for the animals. So we want to be able to upskill too. So some of that money, some additional money is also going towards building men's tables. So those genuine connections for men over dinners, going into training some of those community leaders that have already been identified by rural communities to say, these are the people that people trust in our community. Can you train them up so that they feel more skilled to have those conversations and know where they can send people to and refer people to?
You've mentioned there another one of the things the money's going towards, these 8 men's tables, $200,000 are going towards that. How much consultation was done on whether this would be a good way to reach farmers? I struggle to see many farmers going to a dinner to speak about their mental health issues.
Look, once again, it's not the only initiatives that's going out, but the men's tables were something that our men in particular, the men's tables and the men's chairs, said that were a really easy way for them to engage because it's not necessarily just a conversation around mental health. It's just blokes getting together to talk about whatever's on top of their mind at the moment. And so they have what they call entrees where you can just kind of turn up and go, what is this all about? But the blokes themselves set the rules for those tables and it's just about getting together for a meal. It's not people have said to us, we don't want specific mental health named training or education or services. Some of us just need to turn up with other people who get how hard it is right now. So the men's tables was suggested to us and to SA Health and to Preventive Health as one of the things that works out there in rural communities that men enjoy and like going to because there isn't a shame about going to have dinner with a bunch of blokes. But it's something that they can talk anything about anything that's worrying them at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And there was $600,000 put towards other health initiatives, including the provision of training and support for the broader community, as well as Aboriginal, culturally and linguistically diverse communities. What does that entail?
So there are quite a few things, actually. So there's quite a lot of culturally and linguistic diverse people working out in our rural community. So they have said to us, there are particular stigmas or barriers for them to be able to get mental health support. So they are supporting us to go, what does good look like for them and what services do they need and what messages do they need to go out. So there's some money going into what does a particular service look like for those communities, what does particular services and supports need like to be for our Aboriginal communities out rurally, as well as what training do we know works, has an evidence base in terms of mental health and suicide prevention support. So those trainings have been identified, and that's what I was saying about kind of going out to whatever the local leaders are in those communities and training those up. So those are local mental health initiatives that are already happening in rural areas, and we're identifying where those are. Some of them are our suicide prevention networks that do so much in our local communities and so respected regionally, but they do all of this kind of either from a volunteer basis off the smell of an oily rag. So we're putting more resources into what people know already exists and they go to and they trust.
These are all very worthy causes that are being supported here. I'm questioning whether it should have been included in part of a $73 million package that is designated for drought support. These sound like broader issues that are tapping into money that was meant to be going towards supporting farmers and people directly affected by drought.
I mean, you raise an interesting point, and I guess a lot of, when I go out to regions, a lot of people say to us, look, we don't even like that you're calling it drought relief, and I'm sure there's some political reasons for that, but what they're saying is, well, this is part of our daily life now. We are dealing with environmental crisis and change on a daily, and we want to make sure that whatever we put in place now is something that's sustainable and sticks. And so I think, I mean, and I really thank those rural communities for, you know, turning around so quickly, having engaged with me in particular and other people within health to just say, we're willing to roll these things out. We want them to be sustainable. So we will tell you exactly what it is that works for us and what it is that we want. And so part of the reason that the money is going into things that already exist is because there is an intention that that gets rolled over and increased and grown over time, so that when droughts come and go and when other environmental crises that our rural communities go to and have to deal with every single year, those services continue to exist. So it's better than kind of just plopping a service in there for a short amount of time. These are services that we hope will grow over time.
So, but it goes to the integrity of whether it was right to include it in an emergency support package or whether this should have actually been built into just the overall mental health support for the state.
Another good point. I mean, I'm an independent advocate, so I don't pretend to know the workings of Parliament and the decisions that they made. And I suspect perhaps that using emergency funds and an impetus like an emergency like this allows us to get funding out the door a little bit faster.
Were actually industry groups, Primary Producers SA, Livestock SA, all of these groups, were they consulted as to what they thought would be the best use of mental support services for farmers?
Yes, I believe so. So each this is kind of run by a consortium of a lot of different organisations that has reach out into rural communities. So my office, it was only a couple of people in my office, but we, because I'd been visiting the regions, we had direct connections out into those and we asked them and they in turn asked their communities. I know Preventive Health also have their own networks as well as the Suicide Prevention Network, so they went out and consulted with them. We've got our Aboriginal communities and our cultural linguistic diverse communities, and they were consulted with. SA Health has the NGOs and the regional response teams. PIRSA has their own networks out there in rural. All of those people were consulted with as part of this rollout. But I think the most important thing is that consultation isn't something that happens as a once-off and then goes away and we create a package. The idea of consultation is that it's continuing and ongoing. So as we tell, you know, the people on our lists of those who we've consulted to where the package is at right now, they feedback on how that's going, and we just try and keep them up to date as much as we can as things get rolled out and the money gets out the door.
Have you had feedback from these industry groups like PPSA, GPSA, etc., about how supportive they are of these ideas?
I can only speak for the people that I've been speaking to directly, and that is those out in the community like iFarmWell and rural producers and some of the local suicide prevention networks. But they were really, really chuffed that not only were they consulted with and listened to, but that the money is going into where they told us would work. Because I think there is a bit of a sense that in the past, government money has gone into what governments, know. Whereas I think this might be one of the first occasions where we've said, how about we hold our horses on what we already know and ask the community what they would use, what they would walk into, if they had a dollar, what they would spend it on. And I think all of those teams of preventive health, the Commission's Office, SA Health, the Office of the Chief Psychiatrist coming together to work at all of our individual networks together to make this work is probably the first we've done of this kind. So I hope we get to do more of it.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you coming on the program.
My pleasure.
The South Australian Mental Health Commissioner, Tammy Allen, speaking there. And I'm interested in your feedback. It sounds like there are a number of groups consulted there that weren't necessarily directly relating to primary production. So you've heard there what is available as part of the $2.5 million the state government's putting towards mental health support. If you've got thoughts on whether you think that will work for you, you can text me 0467922891 or 783, sorry, I should say, or call 1300 160 222. We will head to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by senior forecaster Jenny Horvath. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So we're talking a bit about mental health now. I think probably the best thing for people's mental health is if there is any rain on the way. What are you seeing?
Yeah, look, we do have some rain on the way. It is accompanied with some quite strong and gusty winds as well. So we could see some areas of dust in inland parts today and tomorrow ahead of that. Our weather at the moment is being driven by a deep low pressure complex to the south of the state. We actually had our first system move across yesterday, produced a little bit of rainfall. That system's now just a little bit of patchy cloud moving across the northeastern parts of the state, and we're not expecting any more precipitation really with that one as that continues to move eastwards. But we do have our second feature now starting to move across far western coasts, and we do have some showers that have been persisting across Lower Eyre Peninsula and Kangaroo Island this morning. So just having a quick look at some of the rainfall that we saw in the 24 hours up until 9 a.m. this morning on Kangaroo Island there, Rocky River picking up around 13 millimetres of rain, Cape Border 7, Coffin Bay 5 millimetres, Clarendon and Kuiper around 4, Point of Void just under 4 millimetres. So there was a little bit in through that first system, and now a little bit this morning still ticking along. And just having a bit of a look at some of that rainfall since 9 a.m, there's been another couple of millimetres at Cape Border, and it's now starting to see a little bit on Lower Eyre Peninsula as well. So as the day progresses, we are expecting those showers to move across western coasts, reaching central districts as we head into the evening, and southern coasts as well as we head into the evening. Thunderstorm activity at the moment is well offshore, but there is a thunderstorm risk as well as those showers push inland as we head into the later part of today. We will continue to see those showers on and off throughout Tuesday. We are expecting them to push inland and reach the south of the pastoral districts at times, though those showers will be more likely around our Windward coasts and ranges during the Tuesday through there. I should mention we are expecting those winds to pick up, and we do have severe weather warning that has been issued for those damaging winds. So that is relevant for the Mount Lofty Ranges, Kangaroo Island, the upper southeast, lower southeast, parts of the Murraylands, mid-north and Riverland districts. So we are expecting those damaging wind gusts to develop about southern parts of Mount Lofty Ranges during this evening, and as we head towards midnight, extending to those forecast districts that I've mentioned. So we are looking at damaging wind gusts getting up to around 90 kilometres per hour are possible. We are expecting those damaging winds to continue into Tuesday and even overnight into Wednesday before we start to see that easing back. We also do have a coastal hazard warning out for abnormally high tides with the current for tomorrow as well. So that does include our Gulf Coast as well as a southern Fluria Peninsula through there. So quite some elevated waves to be expected. We also do have multiple marine wind warnings for our coastal waters, including quite a few gale warnings for today and tomorrow. And we also do have a warning out for our sheep graziers, and that does include the Mount Lofty Ranges, West Coast, Eyre Peninsula, York Peninsula, Kangaroo Island, Flinders, Mid-North, Marylands, and both the upper and lower southeast forecast districts. So quite a few warnings out there associated with this complex low and the multiple systems moving through. So still expecting those showers to start off the day on Wednesday before contracting back to windward coasts and ranges, and then we will go into a little bit of a drying spell. So just having a bit of a look at the rainfall that we are expecting up until the end of Friday, with really things starting to dry up as we head towards the end of Wednesday there. So it's going to struggle to push into our inland part, so only really less than a few millimetres for parts of the northern agricultural area and the south of the pastoral districts, but we are looking at broad areas in that 2 to 10 millimetre range across the west coast and southern agricultural area, increasing to 10 to 30 millimetres about our windward coast, so those westward facing coasts, and possibly reaching 30 to 50 millimetres about parts of Kangaroo Island, the Mount Lofty Ranges, western coasts of Eyre Peninsula, and those southeastern coastal fringes through there. And even some isolated falls of 40 to 70 millimetres aren't out of the question, especially if we see some of that thunderstorm activity developing more around sort of coastal parts today and then moving a little bit across agricultural areas tomorrow there, Cassie.
Thanks so much for that, Jenny. Hopefully it gets to some of the areas that have missed out this system.
Yeah, but, that's right. Yeah, it's struggling a little bit, but yeah, hopefully we'll start to see some more of those showers pushing inland.
And at least some valuable follow-up for others who are already away. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
That was Jenny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be mostly sunny tomorrow. There's a very high chance of showers in the east, perhaps a thunderstorm in the southeast as well. There could also be some raised dust around in the late morning and afternoon, given that the winds are picking up to a westerly 35 to 50 kilometres an hour during the morning. Overnight temperatures are going to fall to between 9 to 14 degrees, and the daytime temperatures getting up to quite a warm 19 to 23 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy, again a very high chance of showers in the far east, medium chance elsewhere, and a thunderstorm again possible in the far east, as well as that raised dust with the winds again northwesterly 20 to 30 kilometres an hour, swooping around to from the west to northwesterly, getting up to 35 to 50 kilometres an hour during the morning and early afternoon. Overnight temperatures there are going to fall to between 8 and 12 degrees, but the daytime temperatures are going to reach around 18 degrees. It's 28 minutes to one.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. Join us for local news and community happenings. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I'm Cassie Huff. This is the Country Hour. It's great to have your company. Welcome if you have just joined me. Illegal dams have proliferated in the Mount Lofty Ranges in the last 10 years. I'll tell you the extent of the problem soon. And you'll hear from farmers on the West Coast who made it to an event in Streaky Bay to just have a bit of a get together and pick up some stock feed, given just how desperate it is still in many parts of South Australia.
What a great mob of people they are. People from Adelaide all the way over here on a volunteer basis, none of them being paid, but they recognise the plight that we're going through. They're all over here. They've got smiles on their faces. They put smiles back on our face. It's not the end of the world after all, is it?
Yeah, a lot of people say just acknowledging that farmers are going through a tough time is part of the support that people can give. So we'll have more information on that soon. But first, we have to find out the latest in the news headlines. I'm joined by Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, the Foreign Minister says the federal government is preparing to help Australians get out of Israel amid reports the local airspace could reopen. The latest figures show 2,900 Australians and their families are registered as seeking to leave Iran and 1,300 from Israel. Penny Wong says the government has not been able to continue land border crossings out of Israel because of the escalation in military action. Police are investigating the stabbing of a man in Adelaide's northern suburbs this morning. Emergency services were called to Belford Avenue at Devon Park around 4:30. Police say on arrival they found a 28-year-old man and he's since been taken to hospital in a critical condition. And one of the nation's peak motoring bodies says road deaths have hit a 15-year high. The Australian Automobile Association says the past year has been the deadliest since 2010, with about 1,340 deaths. That's almost 5% more than for the previous year. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. An aerial imagery campaign has found hundreds of illegal dams have been built or enlarged in the Mount Lofty Ranges in the last 10 years. This is since there has been a moratorium on building new dams in the Mount Lofty Ranges that was put in 2013. Hills and Fleurieu Landscape Board General Manager Michael Garrett says he's been surprised by the scale of the problem.
We've recently undertaken analysis of high-resolution aerial imagery and revealed a significant number of illegal dams and dam enlargements across the Mount Lofty Ranges and beyond. So it's estimated that in the last 10 years or so, around 400 new dams have been constructed and about 300 have been significantly enlarged across the Mount Lofty Ranges. And that's, you know, enlargements and building of dams that's happened without approval. And in South Australia, all new dams of greater than 5 megalitres in volume or a dam wall height of greater than 3 metres requires a development approval. That goes through local government and is referred on to the local landscape board. Dams of lesser volume just require a water affecting activity permit from the relevant landscape board.
So this is since the moratorium on building new dams was put in place in 2013?
Yeah, the moratorium's been around for more than 10 years now. And even before that, there was a reservation in place to limit new dams because many of the catchments, in fact, the vast majority of catchments in the Mount Lofty Ranges were already over-allocated and under some stress. So these new dams that have been built without authorisation will put the existing water users, and there are 22,000 legitimate dams across the Mount Lofty Ranges, and each one of those dams is owned by somebody who uses the water or relies on it in some way. Many of them are primary producers. So these new dams will deny water getting to those legitimate dam owners.
How much of the illegally constructed dams that you've identified, how many of those have been built in the last couple of years as perhaps a response to the drought?
We actually haven't seen an uptick in going back and looking at the aerial imagery from preceding years. It's been a pretty steady creep of illegal activity over that 10 years. In the Mount Lofty Ranges, we have a situation where properties turn over on average every 7 years, and so we get people coming into the landscape, perhaps taking on a rural property for the first time and not really understanding, I guess, the regulations that might be in place around water use. And some of these illegal dams have been built by people who, you know, happen to have bought a property with a backhoe on it or know a mate who can push some dirt around. And unfortunately, some of them not only are illegal but not particularly well built either. So we've got a high proportion of rural residential or lifestyle blocks, not necessarily bona fide primary producers who are just keen to capture more water on their property.
With these dams now being built, how can you deal with the issue?
Well, in the first instance, we're triaging the hundreds of dams that we've got. So we're identifying those dams that are in a situation where they're most likely to have a negative impact on downstream legitimate users or the environment. And we're approaching those landholders to find ways to ensure that we get to a situation where there's no more water being taken out of the landscape than would have been previously. So in some cases, landholders are able to retire another dam or just decommission the dam that they've built illegally or in some other ways reduce the water volume of water that's captured across their property so it's no more than would otherwise have been captured. But in some cases, the easiest and straightforward pathway chosen by the landholder is simply to remove the decommission, the illegally built dam.
Right, so because I can imagine there could be a thought that, oh, well, it's built now, we can't get rid of it. How easy is it to actually decommission a dam?
Oh, it's, nothing about this is easy, unfortunately, but there are degrees of difficulty, I guess, and some dams that have been recently built are built in a part of the landscape where, you know, it's easy to get machinery into and so on to build the dam, and it's much the same process, but in reverse, obviously, to decommission the dam. It does come with some risks, obviously, you're destabilising a channel potentially, so we do work closely with landholders and the contractors that they're using to ensure that a water course where a dam has been illegally placed is returned to something very close to its original topography and stabilised with vegetation and the like. And look, while financial penalties do exist under our legislation, if a landholder is unwilling to voluntarily comply and we go through the, I guess, through the courts, there are financial penalties of up to sort of $30,000 for individuals and $75,000 for bodies corporate. We hope not to get to that point, and so far we've had very good levels of compliance with landholders who understand that they've done a thing without seeking permission and are able and willing at their cost to decommission the dam. And that's a penalty in itself. I think it's not an easy thing to build a dam and then to have to remove it at their own cost is a significant deterrent.
As we know, there's been a significant drought in this state, and so how much pressure is there on the Landscapes Board in the Mount Lofty Ranges to allow people new ways of collecting water, be it dams or tanks or things like that, given the seriousness of the drought?
Look, we're really keen to get this right, not just for these dry seasonal conditions, for this drought that we're in at the moment, but into the future. And we're working with our communities and industries, as our other partners across government, to help build the resilience of our primary producers. That's going to see new ways of managing water use and water use efficiency and water storage, so that the water that is here, and we are in a changing climate, things are going to change over coming decades. We've got to find new and better ways of storing and using water. Dams in the Mount Lofty Ranges currently lose about 30% of their total volume to evaporation every year, so they're a pretty inefficient way of storing water in the landscape, and building more dams, losing more to evaporation, is just a recipe for less water for everybody. So whether that's an increase in use of groundwater, and our groundwater resources are in much better shape than our surface water resources, so seeing more bores displacing the water use that might otherwise come from surface water dams and the like would be a pretty logical change. Better water storage, sealed tanks and distribution systems on farms to make sure that the little water that is going to be around in the future can be used as effectively and efficiently as possible. They're all trends, I think, that are absolutely necessary and unavoidable as we move forward into a drier and changing climate.
The work you've done to identify the dams that have been illegally constructed have been a specific project that you've been working on, but will this monitoring continue into the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've received some investment through government sources to undertake, firstly, an education and awareness-raising campaign. So we're working very hard to make sure that local government, earth-moving and civil contractors, landholders, primary producers are aware of the regulations around water use and water take from our landscapes. That's the first part. The compliance activity, the direct kind of engagement with those illegal dam owners and negotiating to a sustainable solution. And compliance moving forward is the second part. But the third part will be what we hope to be an automated change detection system using various GIS data, that is aerial imagery and LIDAR, and whatever we have available, so that we can make an annual or more frequent scan across our landscapes and see where new dams or new structures in watercourses have appeared, and cross-reference those with permits that have been granted or development approvals that have been granted. So we will be able to find where somebody's done the wrong thing into the future with much more ease than we've been able to do it so far.
How much cooperation are you getting from the landholders who have illegally constructed or enlarged their dams?
Look, I have to say the vast majority of people have been very cooperative and looking for the best solutions. And look, we're not trying to be out there with a punitive mindset. We're trying to find a solution where this shared resource, these water resources that we rely on for food and fibre production and for lifestyle across the hills, are used wisely. And so we are just trying to make sure that we can get to an outcome where there is no more water taken than would have been taken previously, so that we can have the best chance of having a sustainable water future.
And when you talk about the Mount Lofty Ranges, that is broader than just the Hills and Fleurieu Landscape Board. How far does this work extend?
Yeah, so we've got 9 landscape boards across South Australia, your listeners may be aware. But the Mount Lofty Ranges takes in, obviously, what we call the Hills and Fleurieu is the region that I work in, the northern New York region to our north up to the southern Flinders, the Green Adelaide region, which is the kind of foothills down and including Metro Adelaide, and the Murraylands and Riverlands over on those eastern flanks of the Mount Lofty Ranges. Those 4 regions are all part of the Mount Lofty Ranges, and of course Kangaroo Island is a region in and of itself. And that's the kind of epicentre of this illegal dam situation, is the Mount Lofty Ranges and Kangaroo Island.
I was going to say, have you found much illegal activity regarding dams elsewhere in the state?
Yeah, there's a bit here and there. Kangaroo Island is very similar to the Mount Lofty Ranges in that they've found some hundreds of illegal dams. The difference in Kangaroo Island, of course, though, is that there are open catchments or some open catchments where there is water available. And so had those new dams or dam enlargements been applied for, they likely would have been granted. So in the case of Kangaroo Island, the board there has taken a choice to simply correspond with those landholders who've built dams without the authorisation required, noting that that's the case, but no further action will be taken in those situations. In other regions, we're finding, you know, a few dams here and there, but nothing like the hundreds that we're seeing in the Mount Lofty Ranges.
Hills and Fleurieu Landscape Board General Manager Michael Garrett speaking there. Finally today, on Friday, we heard about the event in Streaky Bay that saw close to 90 farmers picking up some stock feed and free feed for themselves and to catch up with each other. The event was organised by local farmer Susie Kenny after monetary donations came in from the Lions Club across South Australia, which was then put towards 130 pellets of sheep feed made by the Cummins Mill. The Rapid Relief Farmers Community Connect convoy also made its way to town with volunteers helping throughout the day. Brooke Neindorf was there and brings us this story.
For Putra farmer Rebecca Gosling, it was a relief to receive the feed, but also to have the volunteers help load it.
The hardest thing I had to do was hook on a trailer, which was all new to me, and nailed that. Felt proud of myself. Thought I was going to have a stressful moment strapping it all in. But they loaded the bulk bag up and they said, just carry on around there and someone will strap it in for you. So it's been so easy and free-flowing. And then we've come up here and there's a free feed of deluxe bacon and egg burgers, even a baby Chino for Nellie. She's loved it.
And the kids have got toys and stuff
toys.
As well.
They gave me little kookaburra toys and Lego set. And there's Centre Care have given me a bag of goodies as well. It's been beautiful.
For Rebecca and 2 of her children who came along, it was a good chance to not only grab some feed for the family sheep, but also catch up with others in the community.
Oh, it does mean a lot. It just shows that the people are listening and there's a lot of care out there from people that just wanted to give it a go and try and help us. So, yeah, it's been beautiful.
And what will this feed mean for you that you've collected today?
Oh, yeah, it means we were just about to run out of hay, so, yeah, it means can keep feeding our sheep. So yeah, it's just a bit of a load off and it's a relief and just no stress about it, and having to come here and there's been no stress when it's loading up and everything. It's just been all so easy. It's wonderful.
The same sentiments were shared by Streaky Bay farmer Phil Wheaton, who says it has been great to see the support, but it has been a humbling experience.
Most of us people don't take handouts or ask for things, and this has all been done voluntarily, and kudos for everyone that's had a partake in this.
A lot of people I've spoken to today have been farming for many, many years, and they said this is the first sort of handout they've had to take.
Definitely for me, and probably a lot of our neighbours around it all, drought's a funny thing. Unlike fire or flood, it happens straight away, and subject to insurance and a few other things, you work out a plan and get over it. But drought's a funny thing. It's not funny, but it sneaks up on you. And you start off with plan A, plan B, and truth be told, a lot of us end up on plan F at the moment, but we're trying to work our way through it. And it's we talk about decile ones and decile two, And a lot of people around here, it's been a decile 0.5. So this has been some really hard yards, and I've jokingly told some people here, looking after our livestock, looking after the girls to make sure we've got something to work with later on. It's been a hard graft, and I don't know, for some people, I understand why they've got out of livestock, particularly younger ones, but hello, it's nearly enough to make you turn into a vegan, isn't it? We haven't got that far, but gee, I can understand why a lot of the young ones have left the industry. It's a big commitment, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of navel gazing, a lot of second guessing. You're really looking for a bit of direction, and it just goes on and on and on. And if it wasn't for days like today where the community, whether they be small business, whether they be all the volunteers from Rapid Relief, what a great mob of people they are. People from Adelaide all the way over here on a volunteer basis, none of them being paid, but they recognise the plight that we're going through. They're all over here. They've got smiles on their faces. They put smiles back on our face. It's not the end of the world after all, is it?
Some of those that were walking around with those big smiles on their faces were the members of Lions who were in attendance. From the newly formed Streaky Bay Club that was cooking the barbecue to members of the Glenside Lions Club who got the ball rolling when they heard how tough it's been on the West Coast. Steve Ryan is about to step into the role of president of the Glenside Lions Club and says it was a no-brainer when one of the members came to them and said, we should support these farmers.
It all happened in quite suddenly, really, quite quickly. We heard, you know, issues raised about, you know, the drought, lack of feed, and we've got connections in our club at Glenside with this area over here, and they're aware of the plight of the farmers and the communities. So the suggestion was made, and we became aware of Susie, the organiser over here, so we've made contact there. Bear in mind, so we've followed that lead. And everybody at the club was, you know, supportive of doing something quickly. So at our last meeting, they decided we would donate $30,000 to the fund. And then after we've donated the fund, I thought, well, there's a good excuse to come over and visit. So we drove over. Our Glenside Lions Club, we run a bookmart near Burnside area there. We sell a lot of good books, and we're fortunate enough to raise funds, you know, runs which we like to use for the local community events. We include South Australia as local community, anything to help the region. So we're really pleased at the how it's then led on. Richmond Lions then became aware of it. We made contact with them. They matched our offer, so credit to them as well. So it's two Lions clubs. It's Glenside and Richmond. I've got to emphasise that. And then lo and behold, the higher level up in Lions, they also matched some funding as well. So collectively, the Lions, I think, have put in $100,000, I think it is. So, and now I'm learning about farming by coming over here and speaking to all the local farmers. It's really good. I quite enjoy it. So we've just come over. We've been camping in a tent over here. Very windy over here and cold.
Yeah,
but
a bit fresh for the tent.
Yes, absolutely. But really good fun. And you can see, I think it really... I've spoken to some of the people who have been receiving this today, and I think they're genuinely appreciative of it, I think, which we kind of like. And so they may think that, you know, little old Adelaideites like us, like Glenside, up, you know, on Greenhill Road, you think, what do we know about farming? We know very little about farming. But the sentiment for Australian farmers, South Australian farmers, is strong in the city. And I don't think people over in this region should underestimate that. They may think, you know, we're in a different world, and I know we are, but people genuinely admire farmers, I think. I don't know. That's what I genuinely think. And particularly in areas such as this, where it's just hard yakka, I think, you know, and the Australian, I get a bit, you know, the Australian spirit of farming is what it's all about, I think. I don't know. I get a bit emotional, yeah.
There has been a lot of emotion today. A number of farmers that I've spoken to have, just expressed how thankful they are that this event's been put on and that the Lions have got on board. What was it about this area that maybe pricked up the ears of those in the Glenside and the Richmond groups to say, hey, maybe we can help?
Well, some of our members have had either worked or had knowledge of the plight of farmers over here and the communities. So that's kind of, you know, one thing led to another, and very quickly. And it goes to show we can do things quickly when we need to, when there's a genuine cause, a genuine need. And I'm really pleased the fact that we were able to do this in such a short time. Again, like I said, under the leadership here of your local community. But and we're just pleased that, you know, we know it doesn't bring rain and it doesn't do anything, but I think the sentiment is just as important as, you know, so these people will pick up, you know, a ton of pellets or whatever, And we know it's not going to be, you know, I was speaking to one farmer before, he said, look, if this ties us over till, you know, the next few weeks, and then that, you know, hopefully the crops or something, you know, one thing leads to another, you know better than I do. So it kind of is a nice feeling to think at least we're contributing. So we get as much out of it as hopefully they do. And I think they're genuinely appreciative, you know. I mean, I've spoken to just about all of them that arrived and they're all pleased. And so if it gives them a bit of a boost and does something, then we're really pleased.
Steve Ryan from the Glenside Lions Club. The money donated by Lions went to purchasing feed from the Cummins Mill. Owner Bill Butterfield says it's been a busy few weeks getting it all made, but it has been worth doing.
It's been pretty hectic, Brooke, really, but I've got very good staff. We had a toolbox meeting and said, right, fellas, we've got a schedule to meet here. We're going to have to step up and meet that, and they were all over it. And anyway, we did a couple of 1.5 shifts, and they worked all weekend, and we got the road train and another single up here for today's event, and there's a lot more to come.
What goes into making these kind of pellets?
Well, principally it is barley. Now, one thing I must stipulate is that our products don't have any straw or hay in them, and we don't have any artificial proteins. Our proteins are all all come from legumes, so we're 100% grain, and it's principally barley, 80% barley, and then we've got the ingredients that have to go into that to make sure that the rumen balance in the animals is right, and they don't get any problems in their gut.
Were you able to source enough grain for this order?
Yep, we did. We've bought in quite a few hundred ton, because we've got just not this one, and there's more to come here, to come back up here. But it's like I always say, Brooke, you know, it could rain next week, but it doesn't rain feed. So it's going to be a feed that is going to be needed for some time to go yet. And, we've been lucky. We've got hold of it. But it is not easy to get hold of, but we've got some very good supportive farmers around the place that have rung up, especially after they heard about this. I had Tom Phelps ring me up last night, and he said, Bill, do you need some? And great supporters of us, and farmers like that helping us out.
Cummins Mill owner Bill Butterfield. The Rapid Relief Farmers Community Connect convoy also made its way to town, with volunteers helping throughout the day, loading feed, handing out toys, cooking a gourmet breakfast barbecue, making coffees, and also just being an ear to listen. Mick Dunn is the operations manager with the Rapid Relief team and was on site to oversee the whole day.
Well, we've been here to carry out a Farmers Community Connect in Streaky Bay, really about bringing farmers together, giving them a great day out and giving them some livestock feed or pellets or hay, whatever that may be, to alleviate the pressures on farming communities going through drought. And really, our involvement came about through our association with Susie Kenny. She's been a great and very strong advocate for farmers in her area, and has fundraised and networked and done a lot of support, and we were just more than glad to pitch in behind her to help bring this vision to life, really, which is the same vision as ours. Great day out for farmers, great day out for Streaky Bay.
And I think the comment that I've got most today is that how streamlined and how easy it is for farmers. They didn't have to get out their car, didn't have to get that ute or the truck. Everything was done for them once they got here. Is that something that's really important, is just to let them get here and you guys do the work?
This is extremely important for farmers. They're used to doing everything for themselves. They're used to long days with not many people to talk to. Unfortunately, in this area, they're used to daily going out and seeing dirt and dust and devastation. So this is about just appealing to them to disconnect from that, come in and have a good day and go back with a different perspective and definitely more cheered up.
Personally, yourself, when you see an event like this, what do you take away from it?
Oh, it never gets old. It is just so meaningful. I mean, my team has travelled, a lot of them travelled from Adelaide. They've done a 7-hour drive, but they wouldn't miss this for anything. It's just such a rewarding experience. People volunteer because they want to make a difference, and I don't see any other volunteering opportunities with the Rapid Relief team that quite match a Farmers Community Connect. They really are the backbone of Australia. They really do it tough. They are resilient, but they deserve a bit more, and that's what we're giving them today.
Nick Dunn from the Rapid Relief Team speaking there. It certainly sounds like it was an event enjoyed by everyone who took part, and I'm sure a lot of people who donated the funds for the feed are glad to know that how gratefully accepted that support was there. And we'll have a little bit more on this event on tomorrow as well on the program on the Country Hour. But in the meantime, that is all we have time for today. As far as the Country Hour goes, there'll be lots more on your local radio this afternoon, so do stick around. If you want to check out anything that's happening in local, in rural world across South Australia and indeed the nation, you can go online to abc.net.au/rural. Also, don't forget that the Country Hour is podcasted every day. You can just search the SA Country Hour and you'll be able to bring up the entire show. It's put up online each day, so you can catch up on anything you might have missed if you were keen to listen back or catch up perhaps if you've missed the program. Hopefully many of you are out in tractors seeding now and that you've been able to get rain to get away with your program, or at least finish off what you might have already started dry. So take the chance to listen to the Country Hour on the podcast. That's all, though. It is coming up to 1 o'clock, time for news.
It's darker, wilder, and much deadlier.
Don't be modest.
I'm Marta Dasadov. Come back with me to Bay of Fires.
The darkly hilarious new season of Bay of Fires. Sunday nights on ABC TV and ABC iView.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.